The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Doing great.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's warming up.
Yeah, it is. What are you smiling about?
Because it's warming up.
Yeah, it is warming
up.
The
snow looks pretty, but I hate it when it's cold.
You know, I took pictures walking the dogs this week. So, you know how the plows come down the street to clear the streets?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think they dump all the snow? At the intersections.
Yeah.
And I guess they don't think anybody's a pedestrian in the whole city of South Euclid where I live.
Or a cyclist.
Or a cyclist. Well, at least they're in the street.
When they can get there, right.
But I can't even, you know, there are no side, all the sidewalks are covered. The people, you know, the plow drivers who come and clear your driveway, they dump it all on the sidewalk. Then the big plows come, dump it all at the intersections and the sidewalk. It's just really annoying.
You know what? I have a perfect solution for that, and I'll get back to you in about 6 weeks on it, okay?
It's called spring?
Yeah.
Hey, Radiothon's over.
Yes, it is.
Yes, and I think it was successful. We will not know the full tally until they download everything. But I'd like to thank all of you who participated, took the time to donate to WJCU for our once-a-year fundraiser on behalf of the Outspoken Cyclists. Here's some interesting statistics that I got. Almost 50% of the pledges came from outside of Ohio for the Outspoken Cyclists.
And it was kind of nice being in the studio, getting to chat to some of the people that called in. We don't get to do that during the show, so it's a lot of fun.
That may change. I am thinking of doing a podcast where listeners can send me an email saying, I have a question for you, and we will call listeners and answer their questions on air and turn it into another podcast. Do you like that idea?
There we go.
Okay. Anyway, regardless of where you are, where you hear the show, when you hear the show, all the support we got means just the world to us. It was very, very nice. So we are going to begin thanking our donors. This week, I've just picked a few of the first names that came through, and I'll just tell you their first names and the city and state where they listen to the show. Huge thank you to Frank from Houston, Texas, John from Cleveland Heights, Scott from Scarsdale, New York, Steve from from Euclid, Ohio, Lou from Phoenix, Blue Lou, Robert from Grinnell, Iowa. See, pretty diverse group, huh?
We get around.
Yeah, we'll thank another group of folks next time. We'll let you know how close the station got to its goal of 50,000 this year. So all that said, we are going to move on to our regular part of the show this week.
Regularly scheduled program.
Regularly scheduled program. Somewhere in the middle of my conversation with Connie Carpenter Finney last week was the mention of USA Cycling and its new director, Derek Bouchard Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, you remember that. This week, we have a lengthy conversation with Derek about his background and his education, his work history, and his interest in participation in cycling. He is probably one of the most and best educated people in our industry ever, 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 ever. His degrees are from Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford. How much better does that get?
It doesn't.
It is Ivy League to the nth degree, right? All those things, all those credentials have given him a unique set of skills to tackle the multi-headed beast that has been USA Cycling. We have some hopes that there will be new life breathed into it with Derek's current position. And I think his respect of cyclists and the organization that he hopes to form with his tenure will show up. We're going to break for news after that. Come back with a pair of enthusiastic kids from Boston who love to party on their bikes. Greg and Alita are two young enthusiastic cyclists who have turned that enthusiasm into a monthly party for Boston residents. It's the Boston Bike Party. That's the name of the organization.
I think we do that in Cleveland already, and a lot of other cities do that also, but they take it to the next level.
They do take it to the next level, replete with costumes, music, and food. It's like an East Coast Mardi Gras every month. So let's head on out to Colorado, and let's speak with the head of USA Cycling, Derek Bouchard Hall. Derek, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yes, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks. I don't get to talk to too many people who have the kind of background and education that you have. Would you briefly give us a little bit of your background, and then we will move on to your cycling history and how you ended up at the USA Cycling Organization?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a distant suburb of Boston, a rather quiet town, playing all the ball sports, baseball, basketball. I ran track, and I spent almost as much time playing sports as I did as a student. I was a good student as well. But I loved sports and just spent my entire childhood playing sports all the time. Ended up going to a university at Princeton, wasn't good enough for the ball sports to play there at a top school. But I was intending to be to run track there. I was a decent runner, but I had an injury, a heel injury, which forced me to stop running for a while. And that's when I picked up cycling on a collegiate team, which originally was simply to stay fit so that I could, once my foot healed, that I could go back to running. But I fell in love with it immediately. And then cycling became my primary extracurricular activity through my entire educational experience. And I absolutely loved collegiate cycling at Princeton. I still expected to be a structural engineer. I was doing a bridge design. I thought I was going to build bridges. That's what I wanted to do. I went to graduate school at Stanford to study structural engineering. But I kept racing when I was at Stanford. And that was a wonderful place to be a cyclist with all the Santa Cruz Mountains there. And that's where I really started to pour a ton of time into it. And so when I finished my school, I had a difficult decision to make as to whether to go get a bridge design job in Pittsburgh that I had an offer on the table, or to join Shackley, which was one of the top, really the top amateur team in America at that time. I thought the idea of driving around in a van across the country racing bikes was just the greatest thing ever. So that's what I did instead.
Clearly what your parents would have wanted you to do.
Well, it's funny, you know, it wasn't easy because, you know, high opportunity cost to do something like that. But I loved it. It was actually an easy decision. And I was fortunate to have parents that fully supported that, because they knew how much I loved it. And that began what turned out to being almost 10 years of racing my bike full time. And then after I did my 10 years of racing, I felt like I'd been away from civil engineering for so long. I wasn't really sure if that's what I wanted to do. I became interested in other things. And like many people that looking for a way to make a career transition, I ended up going back to school. And that's when I went to business school at Harvard, spent 2 years there. And then I tried very hard to return to the sport in a management capacity, but nothing seemed quite compelling. And it was in the heart of the darkest days for the sport in terms of doping as well, which was frustrating. And so I did what many people do. I went into consulting first with Ernst & Young and then with McKinsey. And then I ended up working for quite a long time, 6-7 years in management consulting. I ended up getting out of the consulting business and joined a company which was growing very rapidly, an online retailer based in the UK called Wiggle. And then I spent 4 years with Wiggle, ultimately leading their international business. They're primarily outside of the UK, they're a global business. And I ran the international business there. And it was it is a cycling related business, which was part of the appeal, not only. And that was quite a bit of fun because I was involved in the launching of the Wiggle Honda team, which was great. And then a recruiter contacted me for the head job at USA Cycling, and went through that process, and that's how I wound up here. So that's the That's the 5-minute version of my professional background.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Derek Bouchard-Hall. He is the head of USA Cycling. He has a very starred background. I mean, it's just awesome. So can we back up a second and ask a couple of questions? One of the reasons you retired from cycling was due to something called exterior and common iliac endofibrosis. What is it? I've never heard of it before, although I understand what each of those words means individually. And how did it or does it affect you?
Well, yeah, it's actually a reasonably common cyclist injury among those that ride full time. But it's basically a thickening of the major artery that goes down to the leg that runs through the hip. And due to the millions of pedal strokes that one takes in a career, what can happen to some people is that artery wall thickens down. It's so that it's a body's natural response to make sure that the artery doesn't kink like a garden hose would kink. The way it stops itself from doing that is it just thickens the artery wall. But if that thickening goes on for long enough, it restricts the size of the artery to the flow of blood. And so what ends up happening is you have reduced blood flow to your leg, which results in some kind of swelling of the leg and deep pain because it's those muscles go highly anaerobic. That's the story. It's not that uncommon. Other cyclists that you may have heard of have had this. Currently, one of our American riders, Joe Dombrowski, has had this and had it fixed. Stuart O'Grady, the Australian, was one of my peers who had it done. It's not that uncommon. Some speculate about 5% of all professional cyclists will develop it to some extent. And for those of us who have it worse, it can create a problem.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'm just wondering, if there are cyclists. Obviously, cyclists listen to the show. That is who listens. So, somebody might be out there saying, oh, my God, maybe he just diagnosed my problem. How cool is that? I want to go back to something you did at Harvard. You did an independent project on the economics of launching a professional cycling team. What did you find out there? Because we talk about sponsorship all the time on the show and how difficult it is.
Well, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult. I spent a lot of time talking to directors who were running successful programs. That's where I learned just how it's a constant battle to keep a sponsor. And even though you can build an incredible team with a staff and success record, the minute you lose your sponsor, your business ceases to exist. So basically, you have a business where 100% of its revenue is at risk at the end of a contract. I mean, that's from a business standpoint, it could not be a worse business proposition. The other thing that I found was that the sponsors know how much it costs to run a program, and they typically won't pay any more than what it costs to run your program. So even if you're giving $100 million in value to a sponsor, they're not going to pay you $100 million. They're going to find out that it costs you $20 million to run the team, and they're going to give you $21 million,
right?
And that's it. And they're going to pocket the other difference. And so it's also one where, because you're so dependent on the sponsors, they have the real economic control and capture virtually all of the surplus that is generated by the team. Will go to the sponsor unless you're really lucky. So as a business proposition, it's about the worst business you could ever run. Highly at risk for existing, and very hard to capture economically the benefits of what you're doing. But it was, for me, it was never about building a profitable business. It was about doing something that I loved, that was fun. What ultimately turned me away from it was not the terrible economics. It was that at that period, the sport in Europe was so corrupt with doping, you were kind of left with that. You either participated in the doping or you resigned yourself to a rather mediocre and unsuccessful program. And that was the decision you had to make. And either one I found particularly compelling. And so at the end of that, I said, forget it. I'm going to go get a management consulting job. I can't enter this world. In hindsight, it was exactly right.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Because at the time, nobody knew exactly the level of doping, right? I mean, it's you can only speculate. You see things, but you don't have perfect data, and you have to kind of stitch together what you're watching to kind of develop a picture of what's going on. you know, I think what we found out later, you know, certainly the picture that I had was absolutely spot on. So I feel like I made the right call in that regard at that time.
Once again, I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Derek Bouchard Hall. He is the head of USA Cycling. And what an interesting perspective you have on our sport, which now takes me to you coming to USA Cycling as the head. What is it you want to bring to USA Cycling and cycling in the United States?
Yeah, well, I think USA Cycling is has grown and matured dramatically as an organization. I mean, I was part of the organization as an athlete from 96 through 2000, and even post my being part of the national team, the team pursuit program, I was also part of it. So I was part of it for a long time. I was living here in Colorado Springs for a long period. So I knew the organization very well. I knew what it was then, and I know what it is now. And it's matured incredibly, and has become a much better organization on firmer footing, better economic footing. The membership has grown dramatically in the last 10 years. A lot of things have matured and made the organization better, and yet it has, I think what most people would acknowledge is a very poor reputation with its community, who feels as though the organization has really let everybody down. And I find that amazing, you know, that difference. And so one of the things that I'd like to bring is I'd like to have the organization live up to the expectation of its community, and take another step forward and build off of that foundation. You know, I've been a professional manager since 2002, and there's a lot of sort of high performance culture aspects that I would like to bring to this organization to make it work better. I would like our community to see us as being a force of good in the sport, both because they now understand the things that USA Cycling does do, and also that we actually improve as an organization and really start to serve the community. And in particular, I think we've had a reputation of being overly focused on the elites and being unresponsive and insulated with regards to the grassroots community, and failing to show any leadership on some of the really progressive causes that people care about, whether it's fighting doping or increasing cycling safety or promoting women's cycling. And so I'd like to go right after those. I would like to restructure this organization to be more focused on the grassroots side, and to make the experience for the everyday racer far better, to be far more open and transparent in everything that we do, so people understand what we are and what we're not, and that we listen intensely about what the membership wants. We're a service organization, and respond to those concerns and show some real leadership for the sport, that we are out in front making things better for the sport and embracing these progressive causes. But the only way that's going to happen is that we think very critically about what the mission is of the organization, who we're fighting for, how we structure ourselves to be fit for purpose in meeting those objectives. And since we really have to do a rebranding, that's the other thing, is all efforts must be done in the context that the organization resides. And our context is that our community, not all of it, but some members of our community are deeply skeptical about our organization, about what our objectives are, about our transparency. The only way to tackle that is to hit it head on. You know, open the books, tell the story, let people see what we're doing, make real advances and change, not just talk about it, but actually see positive changes. That's what I'm hoping to do is to drive through all of those changes and help change the role of USA Cycling. We this organization does not want to be known as the bad news bears of the sport. You know, we want to be seen as a positive, benevolent force for good. And I think we absolutely can be, and I think we absolutely should be. That's what I'm here to fight for.
Well, I know that when it was announced last year that you were taking over the organization, there was like this deafening applause throughout the internet saying, well, maybe now something will get done. And you know, and we're looking for honesty and we're looking for those kinds of things. I want to ask about coaching. There have been a lot of allegations about coaches who have been doing bad things with their team members. as I remember years and years ago, the United States Cycling, it was the USCF, right? The United States Cycling Federation. Weren't coaches certified through the USCF? Are they certified through USA Cycling? Do they have to come through you to be a coach of a team?
They don't have to be, but we do have a certification program. It depends on what you're doing, but we do have a coaching certification program, and part of that does include, you know, background checks and say sport training. That is part of what we do. Not everybody has to go through that to be a coach. It's not a requirement, but it is something that we do, and we have a lot of people that do go through that program.
Do you think that coaches should be accountable for what goes on with their team members?
Sure, of course they should. I think what's interesting is you know, what role can USA Cycling play in assuring that accountability? You know, there's some elements of the sports that we have control over, and there's a lot that doesn't. You know, there is a lot of the sport that goes on completely outside of the confines of USA Cycling. But to the extent that we have control over it, of course, we would do everything we possibly could to ensure that sort of accountability.
That would be awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Rio, the 2016 Olympics, and cycling. It looks like we got kind of short shrift. What happened with that?
Well, I'm sure you're referring to the only having two male spots on the team. We have two for the road race, two for the time trial, and that's all. And it's pretty stark when you look at that's fewer spots than Iran got. Iran has three spots. Canada has three spots, and you know, by any measure, that's an immense disappointment. The thing behind that is that the UCI and the IOC are seeking to have broad international participation in the sport of cycling at the Olympics. And that's something the IOC is after. They want it to be a global endeavor. They do not like sports that are only played by a handful of countries. They want it to be a global participation. And, you know, that's something unique to the Olympics, is that global focus. And so what they did is they structured the selection process to give lots of opportunity to smaller countries that are not participating heavily in the sport of cycling, give them opportunities to qualify more athletes, so that you wouldn't have a contest that is basically between Western Europe, the United States, and Australia, that you actually would have Middle Eastern countries, Asian countries, South American countries to be participating as well, which is fantastic. But as you structure these point systems, where they had, it's done on overall UCI points, but they preserved a lot of spaces based on the continental championships, where they have races within the continent, to give the best teams of the continent an opportunity to get riders. As they structured that, it put United States in a difficult spot. It certainly wasn't the intention, but we had a poor year on the UCI rankings for the United States of America, and a lot of reasons for that. But one of the biggest was Taylor Finney coming back from injury. TJ Van Garderen, you know, who had a tremendous year by most measures, but you know, he wasn't able to get the number of points that that we would want to see at the top end, and a bunch of other riders as well, and so on the UCI points, we didn't score really well. So the only way that we were going to get additional spots in was going to be through the Continental Championships, but we've got this difficult thing in America where our best athletes are competing on the international stage, and they're actually prohibited from participating in some of the continental events. So if you're a World Tour team, you can't participate in some of the lower level events. So even when we saw what was happening with the points, we didn't have the luxury of sending our riders to these other continental events to get points, because they're prohibited from participating in those events. And while some of our domestic teams could participate in those, they weren't generating huge points. And so we failed to qualify riders very much through the continental program, and we failed to qualify enough riders through the international program. And so we kind of fell in the middle. And so you have countries that are, you know, do tremendously well at the international level. They qualify their maximum number level of spots. You have smaller countries that put all of their best athletes at the continental level. They do nothing at the international level, but they get spots through the continental. You have us that was kind of stuck in the middle. We couldn't put our best athletes in the continental realm, and our best athletes had a poor year, which is an unfortunate year. And you put that together, and we only qualified two, and some of the other countries that rocked at the continental level could have more, and that's what happened. And I think the UCI understands that their system was vulnerable to somebody like us falling through, and I think they recognize that that the outcome was not what you'd want to see. It's great for those smaller countries, of course, but not great for us. So one of the things that we're going to be doing is fighting to have an adjustment to that system that doesn't leave us vulnerable. Of course, if we have a great year internationally, we shouldn't have to worry about it. But our country, unfortunately, was vulnerable to that system, and that's the nature of international. International athletics is there's a lot of competing objectives that the leaders of the sport are trying to achieve, and you achieve one and you realize that it's come with a significant trade-off, and we unfortunately have been hit by that trade-off.
Yeah, catch 22. I have one last area I'd like to ask you about, and I know this wasn't in my pre-interview notes to you, and that is about what's happening with some of the big races like the Tour and some of the other Grand Tour races, some of the Spring Classics, with Wanda Corporation looking at buying up and basically monopolizing, it looks like, some of the heretofore independent races. What do you think about that? How do you think that's going to affect cycling in the long term? You seem to have a really good broad vision of the sport.
Well, it's a good question. It's very clear that the international sport, the international elite professional level has some significant challenges. It's certainly not structured the way that you would ideally structure it, with the incredible power of the ASO and the Tour de France, and the relative lack of power of the UCI and the dominance of the Tour de France and the calendar. Those are all, it's really difficult. It's not a big focus of mine. I do it as I follow it as a fan, and there are areas where USA Cycling needs to be involved, because in some cases we need to fight for the interests of our American athletes. But really, I got to say, you know, my focus now is on what's happening here in America.
And that was going to be my next question. Does this bode well for American racing, actually, in some way?
I'm not sure that it does. I mean, if you had a complete breakdown of European cycling, that it could defer attention. It's not obvious to me that it would. These are still immensely popular events, and you still have, you know, the top teams of the world competing in them. And while there's a lot of, you know, fighting in the background, still that's where the focus of all the fans are. I'm not really sure what the impact of what's happening internationally has on American bike racing. But it's, you know, we do have some good things going on here, which is we do have three big races with the Tour of Utah, Tour of California, and the USA Pro Challenge in Colorado. That is great. Those also poses some challenges for us, because that is, for instance, created a huge focus of the top domestic teams on those events, at somewhat to the detriment of other events in America. And so one of my concerns is about how we create a robust domestic racing calendar of events that doesn't have its own problem of a few small events dominating the calendar. I think we have some evidence that is the case. It's not really clear to me how the international would impact America, but as I said, that is of a greater concern of mine. Even further, I'll say that, you know, elite cycling is very important. What's happening at the top domestic level is very important, but of greater importance to me right now is the everyday racing experience for individuals. What is it like being a amateur bike racer in America, which is the vast majority of our membership is not aiming to ride the Tour of California. They simply want good local races that are safe, not very expensive, readily available. They don't have to travel too long. Enough people in the field to compete against, and there's some difficult trends there that we need to combat against. We're seeing a fall off in the road cycling membership a little bit, and that is that is concerning, and that's where my core focus is right now, is trying to make sure that the everyday experience for the amateur bike racer is as strong as it can be, and that USA Cycling is playing as a productive role as we possibly can in developing that.
Well, that's a really good note to end on, I think. It's really fascinating talking with you because you have such a really well-rounded grasp of cycling in our country. And I've seen such a change. It'd be nice to see it come around again to something reliable and trustworthy. And I hope you being at the helm will make that happen.
Well, thanks, Diane. We're working really, really hard to do good and be right for the community.
Well, let's talk again sometime in the future and see how things are going. How's that?
I'd love to.
All right. Well, you have a great evening. Thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with me today. And we'll talk again, as promised.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Derek Bouchard-Hall, we are going to take a break and we'll be right back.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back. After a break on The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm your host, Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
Yes, you are. And it's time for a little bit of news this week.
A little bit of follow-up from a guest that we had on a couple of weeks ago.
Who that?
Mr. Walton.
See.
His website is up and running now.
Oh, cool. You know what? I didn't look and I should have. It should have gone up on the 16th.
WaltonCustom.com.
Yeah.
I did check the other day and it was up right on schedule. Nice site. A lot of fun stuff that you're going to find there. So
cool.
There you go.
Hey, I've got a shout out.
Uh-huh.
Jackie Crowell.
Yes.
She and Quentin were married this week. I want to congratulate them on the occasion of their wedding. The photos of her and Quentin are just glowing. It's wonderful to see her so happy and healthy. So many, many, many happy, healthy years.
Yep.
Okay.
That's great for
Move
her.
On.
Video of the week.
Yes.
Cycling Weekly. Watch this video of a kid doing cyclocross will warm your heart.
Oh, my God. It's the cutest thing ever.
Did you see this? Could this be a future world champ? Watch this little kid. As he conquers the cross obstacle like a future pro. Plus, the rest of the cycling videos that they have in the week are really good. So if you go to cyclingweekly.co, and this was posted on February 17th.
Okay.
And this is a little kid. What is he? Probably four. And
picks up the little bike.
Yep.
Takes it right over the barrier.
He's just got a little bike and he just takes it and tosses it over the bike and hops over and goes on. It's really cool. I wish we all had the enthusiasm that he has for that.
Right. I don't know if you know about this story from Atlanta. Statement from Mayor Kasim Reed on the death of Alexia Heineman. My deepest condolences go out to the family and friends of Alexia Heineman, the 14-year-old Grady High School student who lost her life in a cycling accident on Monroe Drive over the weekend. Now, there was a correction made online, but not to this article, that somebody said it wasn't a cycling accident. It was an automobile accident. It was a crash, and the automobile killed the little girl, not the bike, obviously. The safety of pedestrians and cyclists remains a priority for my administration, said the mayor, with $37 million in the Renew Atlanta Infrastructure Program committed to making sidewalks and streets safe for people of all ages and abilities, whether they are walking, biking, or riding. We value our partnership with the cycling and pedestrian advocacy community who have been engaged with the city to adopt policies and practices that prioritize people over cars. Grady High School, Piedmont Park, and the Atlanta Beltline East Side Trail all converge at the intersection of 10th Street and Monroe. The Renew Atlanta program has $2.5 million allocated for a complete street overhaul of Monroe Drive, and we will move quickly to get these improvements done. The safety of Atlanta's pedestrians, bicyclists, and traveling public remains this administration's top priority. My senior leadership team, including the chief city's chief bicycle officer. How cool is that they have one? We'll work closely with the Atlanta City Council to continue making Atlanta a city that supports all modes of transportation. So our condolences go out to the family of Alexia Heinemann, and hopefully there'll be some follow-up on this.
Yes.
Yes.
So, good laws, bad laws.
We
find those all the time.
It's like good cop, bad cop?
No.
Okay.
So, this comes from Nebraska, the Beatrice Daily Sun, which is their local newspaper. The Beatrice City Council amended city code Monday. That was last Monday night. And made it previously illegal to ride an unregistered bicycle within city limits. The city administrator said that the code was not being enforced and recommended the outdated regulation be removed from city code. It didn't matter if you lived in town or lived out of town. If you rode a bike in town that was not registered, it was illegal. And guess what it was? Guess what the fine was?
What?
Up to $500 for riding. And so here, common sense. They didn't enforce it. They've never arrested or stopped anybody. They said,
but
we don't need
this. But let's
have
it on the books anyway, right?
Well, they're doing a great thing and clearing it up and getting it, you know, off the books.
That's a good thing.
Okay. Now, let's go bad news. Bad
laws. Oh, that's right. Good news, bad news. All right.
South Dakota House Bill 1073 would require cyclists to dismount when letting faster vehicles pass. Right-of-way laws usually prioritize more vulnerable travelers, but a recently introduced bill in the South Dakota drastically bucks that trend. Per House Bill 1073, if a car approaches a cyclist within a no-passing zone without a road shoulder at least 3 feet wide, the cyclist shall stop the bicycle, move the bicycle off the road, and allow a faster vehicle to pass.
What the hell?
That's right. If a car is trying to pass you, you will be obligated to stop, dismount, and walk your bike. Also,
this is from the crack of you-know-what department.
The bill would also rescind cyclists' ability to take lanes without shoulders. So we had a whole thing last year with Cherokee, with on the road. So this is, I saw this, and it's just...
This is a backwards law.
Yeah, it's definitely a backwards law. So this is one that we're going to pay attention to, and if you have any interest in this as a cyclist in South Dakota, it's House Bill 1073, and you might want to ask some questions of your representatives on this.
Exactly. So this comes from Lava Magazine. Now, we don't do much reporting from Lava. It is a multi-sport triathlon magazine, and this is interesting. I had no idea this was going on. Head cycling, and if people know who Steve Head was, he did pass away, I think, created these amazing wheels back in the day, and Specialized Bicycle Components have announced the creation of a cooperative relationship in which the two innovators in the bicycle industry can share technology. Wow, instead of like ripping each other off, they're going to share. Build products and collaborate to bring the most advanced cycling components to a broader market of cyclists. As part of the collaboration, Specialized will license Head's U.S. patent number 8888195 directed to aerodynamic bicycle rim shaping and design. Head filed for this patent on June 9th of 2009, and it was approved by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office on November 14th, 2014. Took 5 years. Whatever. The relationship between Head and Specialized is an alliance between two companies committed to advancing their products in order to better serve their customers. Head's reputation for speed began in the 80s with the invention of the modern aerodynamic disc wheel. Head continues to, quote, reinvent the wheel, unquote, through a commitment to providing the best possible, most reliable, fastest, and most well-rounded cycling products. Since its founding in 1974, Specialized has lived by the motto, innovate or die. The wind tunnel is one example of Specialized's continued commitment to creating the most aerodynamic, highest performance products on the road. Specialized and Head look forward to the opportunities the relationship can provide and to the continued opportunity to earn the position as the rider's brand of choice. So that's going to be interesting. We need to say this now. The National Bike Summit's coming your way. March 7th through 9th, 16th Annual Gathering of Bike Advocates, Industry Leaders, Congressional Champions will again take place at the Renaissance Hotel in downtown Washington, D.C. The premier advocacy event of the year, the National Bike Summit and Women's Forum, unites the voices of bicyclists on Capitol Hill. Summit has shown its real impact, leveraging increased investments in bicycling at the federal and state and local levels. This year, the theme is Together We Lead. The summit will activate and elevate leaders from all areas of the movement. The summit will propel this unified and diverse voice for change on Capitol Hill and beyond. So there are keynote addresses from government officials, members of Congress, leaders from advocacy and industry, workshops that highlight innovative advocacy ideas and trends from around the country, and an organized lobby day, which is usually on Thursday. It's a ball. It's a lot of fun. You actually get to go into your congressional or Senate offices and talk with those people you put in office. How cool is that? And, you know, the elected officials, as we call them. So it again, it's bikeleague.org, and you can sign up for the National Bike Summit. It is March 7th through 9th.
So we hate reporting on stories of stolen bikes,
but
this one we will, because it has me questioning at the end of the article. And this is from the KOB Eyewitness News 4, and they're out of Albuquerque. Thieves targeting high-end bicycles. A security camera caught the moment the thief stole a bike from on top of the employee's car in a parking lot of a Sports System on Montgomery Street in Albuquerque 2 weeks ago. Happened in broad daylight, and the bike was worth $6,000.
Okay, who leaves a $6,000 bike on top of the car? That would be number one.
That'd be number one of my questions. Zach Ratzlaff, the Sports System service manager, said that he hears from two customers per week who have their bikes stolen. The bikes they're stealing are high value, easily recognizable bikes that are worth a lot of money. So it's easy to sell them if you're willing to sell them for a fraction of what their value is. Across town at a Trek Bicycle Supercenter, they've spent $5,000 to install a metal gate and lock up at night after thieves smashed through the front windows two times in 3 days last month. They lost six bikes, with the total equaling $30,000 in losses.
Yep.
Once the bikes are gone, chances of tracking them are slim to none. That's my problem right there. We have enough technology today that you can stick things in a bike, that you can do whatever.
Why are you not tracking it?
It shouldn't get stolen in the first place.
A.
Now, at midnight, if somebody's breaking into a store and stealing it from the front, that's a little bit different, and I understand that. And the other point that they made in this article is they're in Albuquerque. They're in New Mexico. So it's easy to transfer the bicycles to Colorado, Arizona, Texas, or even in New Mexico to dump them relatively cheaply. But we have plenty of GPS little things that you can put on a bike to track it. So this is for people that if you're listening to this and your bike is on your rack outside,
go
quit
get
listening.
It.
This is the only time you're ever going to hear me say this. Stop listening. Go put your bike in a safe place.
Unbelievable. All right. On that note, we are going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back with our last little interview with the Boston Bike Party. Woo! You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Hello, Boston Bike Party, Alita and Greg. Thanks for joining me on The Outspoken Cyclist today.
Thanks for having us.
It is my pleasure. Tell us, and whoever wants to jump in on any of these questions, just go ahead, you know, look at each other and go, okay, I want to do it. No, I want to do it. Tell us a little bit about each of you, and then we'll talk about the organization.
Sure. So I can start. So my name is Greg Hum. I love biking. I love cities. I love biking in cities. And I think more than anything, I just love getting people together for fun things. It's kind of been something I've been doing since I was a kid. did, like either for getting my friends together to ride bikes around town or playing video games. And it kind of just felt natural when I started biking in Boston. That's where I have been living for the past 10 years to get people together for fun bike rides. So that's kind of what I do. I'm also a computer nerd and an outdoors nerd outside of organizing bike rides.
So what kind of bike do you ride normally?
It depends what kind of day it is.
Yeah, somehow I saw that one coming. All right. So having your stable of bikes, what are your two favorite bikes? How can I go there?
Sure. My number one favorite bike is my folding bike. I have a folding bike made by a company called Bike Friday out of Portland, Oregon.
Yep.
Eugene. But basically, you know, I love traveling. I love visiting different cities, different places. I used to take vacations with my family, and we'd have to drive around whenever we'd get to wherever we were. And I thought that was just the worst, with not having a bike and having to drive around or walk to places. And it was a total revelation to me when I realized I could buy a folding bike, pack it up into the size of a suitcase and carry it with me, just throw it in the trunk of a car, pack it on the airplane easily, so I could always have a bike wherever I traveled, you know? So just having that access to a bike wherever I was kind of changed my life. You know, I could visit Cleveland today with a folding bike without a problem and have my bike with me.
Yep, that's true. So Alita, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I have lived in Boston for about 3.5 years. And I've been riding a bike in a city for about 2.5 of those years. I did a little bit of road biking before that, but minimally. So I moved to Boston. I spent about 9 months using public transportation to get around. And based on sort of where I was living and trying to get to, I, as the crow flies, was trying to get about 3 miles, but having to take 45 to 60 minutes to get somewhere.
I'm sorry. That just is like ridiculous.
And so then Boston has an excellent bike share called Hubway, which is, you know, where they, these bike stations, and
right,
you sort of check a bike out for within 30 minutes and return it at another station. And I started using that just to see what it was like. I was very scared of biking in a city and biking particularly on Boston roads. But within a couple of weeks, I just realized that I was saving an hour a day of my life by not commuting, by bike. So I had a road bike that barely worked, but I took my road bike to what has now become my favorite bike shop, and they fixed me all up, and I became a daily bike commuter.
You're allowed to say the name of your bike shop on the air.
My personal favorite bike shop is Bikes Not Bombs Retail or Bike Shop that's in Jamaica Plain in Boston.
Very nice.
There are several other excellent shops.
So let's talk about Boston Bike Party. The way I found out about you was from Richard Fries, who is the head of Mass Bike. And I know that he has recruited some people to help move their offices to the new CIC building via bike and cargo bike and trailers and all of that. And then he said, you need to talk to Boston Bike Party. I'm like, okay, what the heck is that? So tell us what it is as an organization, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty a little bit of how it works.
I can start with that. So Boston Bike Party is exactly what its name implies. It is three of the best things in the world. One, Boston, two, bikes, and three, a party. But it is literally a party that happens to happen on bikes around Boston. And what that means is we get a bunch of our friends and strangers together for a monthly group bike ride where we dress up in costumes, we play music on the ride with our special music bikes, these huge sound systems that we tow around on trailers. And we have a tour of the city, and we can visit cool places like the waterfront or different parks, and generally just spread the joy of biking and Friday evenings through the city as we ride. And usually we end at a social gathering, either at a beach if it's warm or at a bar if it's cold. This past month, we had a very short bike ride and a very long after party.
Yeah, I would imagine. You also had a blizzard or something. So how many people typically show up to one of your bike parties?
In the summer, last summer,
let's go with summer because that's when most people were out and riding. That's true. Right.
So our maximum tends to be June, July, and August. And last year, that reached right up to about 500 people.
Wow.
And in the winter, we still get 100 to 150.
Do you have to get a permit to do this ride each time?
We do not need to get a permit. And the reason is because we follow all the rules of the road. And in the very early stages of bike party, me and a few of the original planners had met with the city and met with Boston police just to tell them what we were doing. And we were very clear about, bikes are vehicles according to mass law, just like cars are, and we have a right to the road. And, we're a community gathering, and we put out a route, but we're not an organized event where we need people to cordon off the road. So the cops' attitude is, if you guys are following the rules of the road, I don't see the problem here.
Well, it's not like you can go fast in Boston anyway, right?
Exactly. The idea is to have a slow rolling party on bikes.
Got it.
That's really the idea.
Got it. So who typically attends your events? How many? If we get 500 people, who's showing up? Do you have a broad range of age group and gender and all of that?
Yeah. So it's a very diverse group. And one of the most interesting aspects of that is the age diversity. We have everybody from 18, college kids up to many people who are 50, 60 years old. And we all become friends and all those ages in between. So there are people who have kids and people who are college students, and everybody is equal in terms of sort of how friendships and interactions go. We've also, definitely have good gender diversity. I know that there are many female cyclists who love bike party, in part because, we don't feel like we're in this, boys club of biking. And we each year have tried to have had very successful sort of one more women-oriented bike party. To encourage, women in the city who might be intimidated to get on their bikes in the city and just come join us. And we definitely have a racial diversity as well.
So it's definitely, to recap, it's people from all walks of life around Boston, people of all ages, people of all professions. It's anyone who likes to ride a bike in the city. You get your average everyday commuter. You do get your weekend road warriors. Sometimes they do come on bike parties just for fun, but it is mainly a social event. We're not riding very fast. The point of it is to ride together as a group and to meet other people. So you get people from all walks of life and colors in Boston. So that's one of the coolest things about it.
That is cool. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with two of the members of Boston Bike Party, Greg and Alita, and we're talking about what it is and what it does and where it goes. So I wanted to ask about your lookbook. So when you go to the website, you have something called a lookbook. And I was corrected thinking that it showed up after the ride, but you actually produce your lookbooks before your rides?
Correct.
Okay, so how do you do that?
How do we do that? So I guess in fashion magazines, a lookbook is, like a series of photos to kind of give you a sense of what this year's fashion line is, for what the latest style is. And the San Francisco chapter of Bike Party is a global phenomenon.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but Bike Party did start in California, in San Jose. It branched out all over California, the cities all over California. And there's actually one in Akron, Ohio, believe it or not.
No way.
Yes, there is.
That's only 30 miles from here.
Only 30 miles from here. So you might have to hop on that bike party train.
not yet.
But maybe not yet, but maybe one day. So San Francisco had the idea of stealing that lookbook idea from fashion magazines, because they really wanted people to dress up in costumes for their bike rides.
I think one thing, yeah, so the lookbook comes out of the fact that each bike party each month has a theme.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of work goes into those themes, and the theme gets actualized through the artwork that we use to advertise the events, which is primarily on Facebook and on the website. But then the theme also comes into play with how people dress up in costume, and also with what music gets played.
Huh.
So that's why there's a lookbook each month to sort of help people just sort of start ideas of what kinds of costumes they might choose for that month.
So yeah. here's something that didn't occur to me until just now. Yeah, how is it financed?
Bike parties can put your volunteer run, so there's no financing other than money we collect for T-shirts, and that's all for fun. So there's no money involved in the day-to-day or monthly operations of bike party.
We have excellent volunteers who are bike party members who do artwork for us each month.
People yes. who love bike party.
People love bike party, and they volunteer to do the art for us. And then the rest of it is just sort of volunteer work.
Yep. So we have about like a planning team of about, you know, 10 or so people at any given time. And all those people have different skills. So everybody volunteers their time. There's no money exchanged in the services.
And how much time do you devote to it each month?
I guess it depends who you ask. So I help found Bike Party. I don't know how I can put a number on how many hours. You know,
I know just what you're saying.
You know,
I know, like, it's a labor of love. I got it. So is there an altruistic, like a fundraising aspect? Do you guys do community stuff too?
So I guess we consider Bike Party itself as, you know, a giving back to the community, or just a community building activity, right?
Great answer. That's awesome. Yeah. Yep. I got it.
Yeah. So
we have occasionally done a few drives. So we had a theme that was Red Sox, SOCKS.
Kind of like the baseball.
Like the Boston Red Sox.
Got it.
Love puns at bike party and wordplay. It's very important.
Yes, it is.
But so for that month of the Red Sox, we also collected socks for a sock drive that was being organized by one of the homeless shelters in Boston.
That's cool.
And then we've also done like a gift and toy drive in December.
Yeah.
So occasionally we incorporate something because we know that our bike community loves participating in those. So as much as we can organize them, we try.
So what's your next bike party? When is it and what's the theme?
Yeah. So Boston Bike Party is always on the second Friday of the month.
Okay.
So it's
just about to happen.
Yes. And most people hear about Bike Party through Facebook. So we have a page, and then we create an event for each individual bike party. But then we also occasionally get some, you know, local press, and people hear about it that way.
We have a website, bostonbikeparty.com.
Yeah.
You know, always look at our website for updates.
Well, I think it's just fascinating. I can't believe we have one in Akron, and I've never heard of it. Tim is shaking his head going, really? Is that possible? I hope you guys have a lot of fun on your bike parties all year. Thank you so much for talking to me on the show this week. And if I'm in Boston, I'll look you guys up.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye-bye. Greg and Alita from Boston Bike Party joined us on the show this evening. Woohoo! Let's go have fun in Boston.
So usually when I go to Boston, it's for rowing, but I'll make sure that I schedule that if they can schedule the head of the Charles Regatta with a bike party event.
I am sure that you could talk to Greg and Alita and maybe they'll schedule a bike party with the head of the Charles.
There we go.
Right.
I'm sure that would work out great. And that sounds like a lot of fun. And that's what rides like that should be.
Yeah, exactly. And I also thought it was interesting that it's not just for young cyclists. Anybody can come have
right.
a good time. And that I like that because I think of Boston as being a little stuffy sometimes. I know I'm going to get
no,
I'm going to get
Boston is not stuffy.
No?
Cambridge is stuffy, though.
Oh, okay. Pardon me. I think that's it for today. So you've been listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'd like to thank Derek Bouchard-Hall for his a great and insightful interview about his thoughts on USA Cycling. I'd like to thank Greg and Alita from Boston Bike Party. Again, I'd like to thank everybody who participated in Radiothon this year. I hope you have a chance to go for a ride and that it's nice where you are. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.